Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, health officials are applauding the federal order calling for inmates at high risk of contracting Valley fever to be moved from Central Valley prisons. But Department of Correction officials have questions about how the order will be implemented. And how does restorative justice look in the schools? We show you how it's working in one Fresno Unified middle school. Plus, the 27th annual Bakersfield Jazz Festival. Who are some of the big names performing this year? But first, the high number of suspensions and expulsions of Fresno Unified students has school board members reexamining the district's discipline policies. The board recently voted to adopt an alternative form of punishing students called restorative justice. It encourages young people to take responsibility for their wrongdoing and make amends to the victims. Fresno Unified officials say it will take some time to put the new policy in place. But if they want an idea of how the program might work, all they need to do is take a look at one of their own middle schools.
Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, if you're going to justify your answers, use your character analysis to justify your answers.
Jenna Perry's 7th grade English class at Yosemite Middle School sounds like most others.
This is an argument and this is a belief. So if he thinks he's innocent, why does he believe he's innocent?
But there is something that makes her classroom different.
Okay, before we leave today, ladies and gentlemen, let's go over our class goal today. Somebody tell me, should we earn a point for staying on task? Why or why not? Regina.
At the end of every class, before students are dismissed, they go over their goals, which are spelled out in a social contract they all wrote and all signed.
And those social contracts include all the things that students want to see and hear in their classrooms in order for them to excel.
Things like staying on task, following directions, showing respect.
And they have this, what we call a silent check. So if they see somebody that's not meeting the social contract or doing something that breaks that social contract, they can check each other. And it's silent, so you can't yell at somebody, you can't put your finger in somebody's face.
The social contract is just one of the strategies included in a program called Capturing Kids' Hearts. Yosemite principal Ed Gomes implemented the new learning tool as a way to build better relationships between students and adults.
When I first got here, what I noticed was there's a lack of relationship between adults and students. Lots of yelling at them, students misbehaving, students not happy with coming to school. Our attendance rate was in the mid-80s, I believe, or 87%. Not too good, a lot of absences, lots of disorderly classrooms.
In other words, Yosemite was a school where the students were out of control. 8th graders Cristobal Martinez and Emily Byers describe what it was like.
They would disrespect everyone. They would, like, cuss at each other. They'll throw things at the teacher or other students.
A lot of times, brothers, we, like, a lot of stuff and a lot of violence and fighting all the time. And then I actually didn't want to come to school because of all that.
Now when you walk across campus, this is what you hear. No cussing, no put-downs.
What do you think about the principal?
He's an awesome, cool, funny dude. When I'm sad, he makes me happy.
Yosemite is a small school, only 600 students, and it's located literally across the tracks at 9th and Olive Avenues in southeast Fresno. Many of the students come from what you could describe as being challenged homes, single parents, foster care, homelessness. Principal Gomes says school administrators dealt with discipline problems by isolating those students from the classroom and kicking them out of school. He says it was an accepted and expected practice.
We couldn't just sit around and allow this to happen. How else could we start taking care of everything else at a school site when we, you know, expelled in the 30s, suspended in the thousands. That just couldn't be the way for a school of this size. That just didn't seem right.
Fresno Unified statistics show that although middle school students are less than 15% of the total district population, they made up 43% of all expulsions. Principal Gomes set out to change that.
Usually it's when students can't read. Let's open up a book that teaches adults how to better teach students who lack reading skills. But there wasn't so much that for when a student is passive-aggressive or angry in the classroom or disrespectful. Where's the book that helps us deal with that?
Surprisingly, Gomes found the district did have some good training programs. CHAMPS, which addressed classroom organization, motivation, and dealing with chronic behavioral problems.
Thank you for those of you who have your eyes up front. I'm still waiting for a couple people to put their pencils down.
He also implemented principles from Capturing Kids' Hearts as a means to help adults and students connect with each other.
I noticed right away that, oh my goodness, this is exactly what we need. Oh my goodness, this is amazing training. What I learned quickly is that, just like any other training, going to training is one thing, implementing the training is a complete other.
That first year, nothing changed. Gomes says teachers and staff did not buy into the program, and he didn't hold them accountable. Trying to change what he called a system-wide approach to dealing with kids was tough.
There's a reframing that an adult must do, and I'll tell you, that's hard. Kids are resilient. They change quickly. Adults, not so much. So I had to do a lot of changing myself.
So they went back to square one, this time with the understanding it would not be business as usual. Gomes said they all had to come to the understanding that not all kids are taught certain character traits at home. Things like sympathy, empathy, forgiveness.
And I'm not saying that we're teaching things that are outside of the educational realm. Because in teaching this, you're solving classroom issues. Because how many times do you deal with kids not being able to forgive each other? That's what causes a lot of conflict right there. How about empathy? It has a lot to do with how kids treat each other and treat the teachers.
They couldn't just teach it. They had to put it into practice every day.
When she had us come up with ideas, words to go by, I already thought that it was a waste of time. But after a while, when she was telling us to follow the rules and teaching us that, it really got in my head to think about it and to really follow it. And so I actually started trying to do it.
14-year-old Robert Moreno says because of the social contract, he quit hanging out with gangs, stopped using drugs, and started participating in more school activities.
My behavior changed a lot since last year.
A key component in changing behavior is building the relationship between teacher and student. Every morning, kids get 2 minutes to share about their lives, the good and the bad.
Some stories are really emotional, and then teachers see it, how they behave because of maybe it was a depressing childhood. And now teachers could kind of open up to them and show them more love and everything.
That emotional sharing, along with high expectations and rules, has changed the dynamics between the adults and the students. Gomes says it has created a family with positive outcomes.
We've brought our expulsions down about 75%. Our suspension rate's about 70%, 75%, and that's not small numbers. We're not just going 30 expulsions to 27. We're talking 30 expulsions in the past as an average to now an average of 4.
The road to how they got to where they are has not been perfect. It is hard work, but Gomes says it's worth it.
So like I said before, make sure your character analysis are folded up, put them in your folder, and clean up.
You have classrooms that are working and focused. You have, more importantly, they're not doing it because of fear. They're doing it because of respect.
Thank you for those of you who are straightening out your desk. 15 seconds.
We are going to continue our conversation about Yosemite's transformation with Principal Ed Gomes. Thank you for joining us, Principal Gomes.
Hi, yes, yeah, you're welcome, and thank you for having me out here.
Well, I think you are in your fourth year of this program. Is that correct?
I'm on my third year with Yosemite Middle School, where we put in elements of the program, yes.
And what do you think you and your staff has learned about students and how you changed their behavior during that time?
Well, one of the things that we noticed was that without us being trained, without us having strategies that we could implement, then all we were relying on is what we bring to the table. And what I noticed is we have very strong content teachers, but when it came to dealing with students social, emotionally, behaviorally, and so on, we lacked the ability to give training until now. So what I've seen is really teachers taking a hold of this training, these resources, and putting them into play here, and we're seeing the difference.
Well, you talked about, when you talk about teachers teaching content, you know, when a district, like so many districts are, they have been just really focused on improving test scores, how can that impact discipline when you're kind of focused on the scores, because that is your major concern at that point?
Well, I mean, it's very easy to lose sight of what we're here for, because if you just see it as a product of creating a test score, we forget that the product is a human being. It's a child, a person who comes here that has so much more than just a test score attached to them. And it's very easy to get caught up in the let's discipline fast and hard because we got to get back to the learning. And we forget that really to get to the learning is understanding the whole child, understanding their story, implementing strategies, and that's what we sometimes forget as educators.
Do you think that can have an impact on expelling students and suspending students because you're focused on those scores, and if you don't have to deal with discipline, then you can really focus on the test scores?
Well, I can't speak to every case. I know that we need to focus on academics. That's, of course, a major component of instruction, of education. But, you know, one of the books that we've read on Eric Jensen's How to Teach, or Teaching with Poverty in Mind, it breaks it down to, yes, academics is important, but if we're not teaching these other pieces to students on expectations of how to behave, on elements that are missing in their development, in creating strategies and structures within our class, and working with kids in a different way that help build relationships. If we're not putting all that in place, then how could academics even take forefront? There are possibly schools that students come from homes that really build the core relationship piece of a child and understands all the emotional pieces needed to be developed properly. But, you know, unfortunately, I haven't seen too many of those places. And where I work, students come with this missing. And,
well, you talked about, when you talked about Eric Jensen, I kind of want to get into that, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but
no problem.
It's just letting people know that what you're doing is really based on research. When you read Eric Jensen's book and what he talks about, how some kids don't come or aren't taught all of these character traits.
Yeah, he speaks of the emotional keyboard, and he has like a picture of a piano, and that students, as they're being brought up into this world and walking into the educational world of, you know, kindergarten on up, that they might be missing some emotional keyboards, understanding empathy, perseverance, and things like that that we take for granted. We just assume they come with. And his research, and he was one of the top researchers on the brain and education, he really has found that it is shown that students don't have that capacity, and we need to build it in them. We become frustrated when we have no strategies or skills or without the understanding to, like what you said, we go right to the punishment part because that's what the people did before me and that's what they did before them, and it's a human reaction. Something goes wrong and we react quickly to it. We don't teach and relearn. We now get into the business of teaching it. That is the business that we're in.
Now, as you know, Fresno Unified, the board has adopted an alternative discipline methods based on restorative justice. Now, you said you use some of those principles already in your program.
Correct. Restorative justice had a lot to do with like social contracts, where there's voice for the students, voice for the children. So that means they create some of the rules around them in the classroom with the teacher, so the teacher and the students follow it. They learn how to work with each other. They learn how to work with the teacher. It's taught through them through relationship building strategy, and this is fostered throughout the year. And then when there is a problem, let's say, for example, if there is a problem in the classroom, you address it based off of the social contract that we all agreed on. And when it's broken, that it's going against this contract that this group of people have selected in this classroom to abide by. And it changes even the way we give punishment, because now the punishment is no more this authority in the class who's just dealing the punishment. It really is. There's a set of rules that you and I have said we need to follow, and it's all here. We signed it, and now when there's punishment, it's even different. The child understands it and doesn't blame the teacher or the system. It really is those elements that I think has worked really strong within our school.
Why do you think it's important that teachers and educators understand that you teach children these strategies and you teach children discipline? Because many will say, you know, that's not the school's job.
Right. And, you know, what's been great is that Fresno Unified has really opened the doors for training that'll start to change and reframe the way we think of it that way. Like I said, education is an old system, and there's still some really old embedded systems within it. But when things are not working, you have to look at what the research shows does work. So discipline gets you some fast, immediate responses, but has a long-term, negative effect. If we're in the business of long-term, then how are we doing it in a way that shows us in the long-term that this will be best for the child and for the situation? So, that it's really, that restorative justice piece that you think through, where the child now has their voice in it. We're going to understand their story, the origins of where the issue came from. It's digging deeper, but really teaching them through it that helps the whole child. So we've really seen a lot of good, positive results from it.
When you talk about the positive results, we talked about some of that in the story that we did with you. We talked about how your suspension and expulsion rates have gone down. But just what are some of the other things that you have seen on campus and with your students and your staff?
Well, it's really great to see people who come here throughout the past years and now and tell us, like, wow, you know, here's just an anecdotal result assessment that I'm making. I walked the hallway and the students greeted me, looked me in the eye. I didn't hear any cussing at all. I walked into one of the classrooms to greet the teacher, and I saw the students having systems in the classroom that they followed to keep it in order. I hear those things. I hear from parents all the time. Wow, they're so much better. My child really had problems in the elementary, and that's not a normal thing from a middle school to say, you know, my child struggled in elementary and now their behavior is so much better in middle school. That used to be the opposite, and now to hear that being said to us, that our students are doing better now than they did in their elementary years, is a huge tribute to what we're doing. And I mean, the scores, the actual numbers speak for themselves without those anecdotal type of results.
Now, I know you can't speak for the whole district, but what do you think is going to take for Fresno Unified to change its approach to discipline? Now, we saw this with your school. This is not going to happen overnight.
Well, you know, I don't put it different than I do, like, an instructional piece that needs to be done. Let's say there's a missing component in math scores or reading, and there's good research that this is a good way to instruct kids. Well, if you take that frame of mind as a district, you know, we embed what's in training for everybody. There's resources, books, and so on that people have. And then there's, a systematic implementation of this type of strategy or instructional component. And I don't see it any different. You know, we've seen our results. Our results show that things need to be changed, right? Because we're a decision, we're a data-driven district, and the data says something needs to be changed. So we look and see what it is that needs to be changed. We find training, resources to give the people, leaders, teachers and so on, to be equipped how to deal with it so that we can, you know, implement it and be successful with it. I don't try to take it away and make it some magical piece. It's there's so much research, there's so much training. And in fact, it seems like there's almost more training for how to build structures in the school and relationships sometimes than there are of the instructional content piece. So it's out there. The district is now, you know, continuing with the training. It's been around for a little bit, but now it's going to be more. The board has approved this new type of, you know, training for staff, and it's a very positive thing that I believe all schools are going to be implementing. You're going to see some major differences here in the next few years.
Okay. Thank you. Well, if your school is an indication, then there's something to look forward to. I truly enjoyed my time on campus. Thank you so much, Principal Ed Gomes.
Oh, thank you, Juanita. I appreciate it.
And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. There's a paradox in many of the reactions to Governor Jerry Brown's proposal to give California schools more flexibility on how they spend their state tax dollars. There's general support around the Capitol for breaking down the funding walls surrounding several dozen programs. But as Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, everyone seems to have a favorite program they want to protect.
So how tall is that base on that located block?
This is one of the programs with a guaranteed funding stream that could soon go away.
Would you do a mirror option or would you just draw it outright? Probably just draw it outright.
It's a career technical education class, this one at a high school in the Sacramento suburb of Elk Grove. Sal Lascola is teaching his mechanical engineering students something called computer-aided design drafting.
So it's pretty straightforward, right?
Well, it seems that way to Lascola's 34 students, who each have two computer screens in front of them. They're measuring and drawing very precise geographic lines and angles to create shapes with rectangles, cylinders, and cones.
So, -2, 0.
There you go. And right now they're just learning the basics of how to do design technical drawings so that they can create objects that they're going to create in their engineering classes or anytime in the future.
In jobs like
mechanical engineering, manufacturing, civil engineering, they could be architects.
Career Tech is one of 60 state-funded programs known as categoricals. Others include art, music, advanced placement classes, even summer school. Each comes with its own pot of money and its own rules for how that money must be spent. Governor Brown wants to eliminate about three-quarters of them, the ones that don't have strings attached, like federal funds or voter approval. Instead, Brown wants to leave it to each school district to decide how to spend that money. He calls it
the principle of subsidiarity.
That's the governor in his State of the State address this year.
Subsidiarity is offended when distant authorities prescribe in minute detail what is taught, how it is taught, and how it is to be measured. I'd prefer to trust our teachers who are in the classroom each day doing the real work, lighting fires in young minds.
Ask around the Capitol and you'll generally find support for this part of the governor's education funding proposal. Yet, more often than not, that support comes with an asterisk. Take, for example, Democratic Assemblyman Kevin Mullen.
I think the overall thrust is a positive one in terms of local control and giving flexibility to school districts.
But
in some fairly rare instances, I believe the administration of those programs works best with direct state oversight.
Mullen has offered a bill that would exempt a school safety program. He originally wanted to exempt a teacher training program too, but dropped that idea. The governor does have some support without an asterisk. Here's Senate Republican leader Bob Huff.
Of course, there's some in there that I like and would like to protect, but I'm willing to take the things that I like and throw it in the hole and let the school districts make that decision, because the maximum flexibility helps them use the money that they have a lot more wisely.
Democratic Senate leader Daryl Steinberg also generally supports eliminating categoricals, with the exception of money for school buses. He also wants to find a way to ensure Career Tech, one of his priorities, is expanded one way or another.
And make it in the district's best interest to say, God darn, we got to do more of this, right? Without the need for a categorical.
Okay, let's do the next line, and it's going to make it easier for you if you do it this way.
Which should be good news for Sal Lascola, the career tech teacher in Elk Grove. He knows the governor has a tough job dealing with school funding, but insists his program is worth it.
I'm not asking for more money, just don't cut it. Keep it coming if we can, because we do great things.
La Escuela School District says it fully intends to keep his program funded, no matter how the governor's proposal ends up. And that's what Brown wants, for the district to make those decisions, not the state. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Most counties in California have a shortage of primary care doctors, and with millions more people in the state expected to get health care coverage next year, lawmakers are proposing ways to make sure basic care is available in areas that need it. One bill would allow nurse practitioners to treat patients without consulting a physician. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone has more.
Some nurse practitioners in California already see patients without a doctor in the room. Patients like Anastasia Casperson.
Well, my legs and my feet are swollen.
When did that start?
Last night.
Casperson has struggled with homelessness and drug addiction. Now she's at Glide Health Services, a clinic in San Francisco's Tenderloin District.
Had you eaten anything new? Or
her nurse, Tina Clark, used the visit as an opportunity to ask about other health matters, like her efforts to quit smoking.
I'm kind of a little worried because you put on a lot of weight, you're feeling sleepy.
After a half-hour visit, Casperson left with a prescription. She says she's been coming to this clinic for a few years.
They have compassion, for a client. They have understanding for a client. I like the nurses here because they're like one big family and they all work together.
So we're going to wait for her results to come back and then... Mm-hmm.
This clinic is run by nurses with advanced training. Nurse practitioners, or NPs, in California have at least a master's level education. A physician visits 12 hours a week to sign forms and consult on difficult cases. A bill in the California legislature would allow nurse practitioners to provide primary care independently. Supporters say that would enable more people to get care in inner cities and rural areas. Glide Clinic Manager Karen Hill.
It's difficult to get primary care physicians to work in a place here because, the pay is low oftentimes, and there's more money in specialty practice. The housing is incredibly expensive here if you want to raise a family, and the population is difficult.
But Hill says this clinic wasn't started because of a lack of physicians. It was established with help from a nursing school, seeking to serve a vulnerable population.
A lot of what we do around education and teaching and following up and coaching, that's really what makes the difference.
Nurses and nurse practitioners are a very, very important part of the healthcare team, but they are part of a team.
Dr. Paul Finney is president of the California Medical Association. He says nurses have less training and are not as experienced in testing and technology. Plus, he says, expanding the roles of nurse practitioners won't help the doctor shortage. NPs are already busy with patients.
It's very important as we move forward to use teams creatively to create higher levels of safe, high-quality care. We need to keep those teams together. We don't need to disintegrate our healthcare teams.
Finney says the bill before lawmakers doesn't require nurse practitioners to work in a team, as Glide does. So nothing would stop an NP from hanging a shingle for a medical practice in Beverly Hills.
I would be very surprised if, should this bill pass, that all of a sudden you'll see a massive egress of nurse practitioners out into medically underserved areas. I just don't see that happening.
But nurse practitioners are more likely to serve the poor and in rural areas. That's according to University of California San Francisco healthcare economist Joanne Spetz. She says they can be trained much more quickly than a physician. And she says states have varying degrees of restrictions governing nurse practitioners. California falls in the middle.
Nurse practitioner care is very safe. It's very effective. Patients tend to be very satisfied with it. And there's absolutely no evidence that restrictive barriers to their full practice have protected patients or saved anybody's life. There's a fair amount of evidence that those kinds of restrictive barriers inhibit access to care and prevent access to care.
The nurse practitioners at Glide say they'll keep their physician, even if California's law is changed to give them more independence. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
The nurse practitioner bill was approved last week by the State Senate Business, Professions, and Economic Development Committee. It will go to the Senate Appropriations Committee next week. Despite promises from California Governor Jerry Brown and legislative leaders to hold off on new taxes after last fall's passage of Proposition 30, several Democrats are still putting industry-specific taxes forward. Ben Adler reports from Sacramento on why some rank-and-file lawmakers might be going against their party's leaders.
Oil, soda, tobacco. There are proposals to increase taxes on all three at the Capitol this year.
Why would we continue to give away our state's resources to oil companies making enormous profits?
It is my intent that SB 622 would increase the cost of sugary drinks, with the tax being passed along to the consumer.
We should be the leader in the nation when it comes to a tobacco tax rate. Do you agree?
Those are three Democratic state senators. Noreen Evans is proposing an oil severance tax, with the money going to state parks and higher education. Bill Monning is calling for a 1 penny per fluid ounce tax on soda, energy, and sports drinks to fund childhood obesity prevention. And Kevin DeLeon wants to add a $2 a pack cigarette tax for smoking prevention, cessation, and treatment.
Desaunier?
Aye.
Desaunier, aye. Monning?
Aye.
Morning, aye.
The oil and soda taxes each passed committee votes this week. On the same day, supporters rallied for the tobacco tax measure, which is scheduled for its first vote next week. In putting these measures forward, the three Democrats are doing something expressly opposed by Governor Jerry Brown and their own Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg. The governor's office says Brown's campaign position of no new taxes without voter approval still applies. And this week, Steinberg reiterated that this is not the year for new taxes.
You know, on the merits, I support a lot of these things. That's a different question from whether or not in 2013 tax measures ought to move through the process.
Anti-tax advocates are cautiously relieved, at least for the time being. David Wolf is with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association.
It might just be a stopgap towards a bigger push next year. And, you know, while we're certainly encouraged, we still believe the stuff's going to be coming down the pike at some point.
Democrats now hold two-thirds supermajorities in the Senate and Assembly, something they lacked for years. That's enough not only to pass tax increases, it's enough to override potential Brown vetoes, meaning the governor's no tax pledge might prove irrelevant. Former Democratic State Senator Deborah Ortiz says legislative leaders may need to balance competing pressures on these proposals.
They follow the will of their membership, and if there's a strong two-thirds vote among their Democratic caucus, they have to balance that interest, respecting the governor, being a partner with the governor. But then if their membership says to them, we want this, and there's two-thirds, and that's a whole nother variable.
Even if the tax increases fail this year, there are still several reasons Democrats might push them in the face of their leader's opposition. First, they might believe the bills are good policy. Second, they get exposure and media attention. And third, they could lay the groundwork for passage in the future. Ortiz knows that. She authored previous soda and tobacco tax measures that stalled in the legislature several years ago.
We just have to think about this as a process that may play out a little longer than what we have before us today.
For now, each author hopes his or her bill will get a fair hearing on its merits, although business groups have already labeled two of them job killers. Here's Senator DeLeon.
Those three letters, T-A-X, have such a negative connotation for a whole variety of reasons, you know, that once you get suckered into this, mired, I should say, into the trenches, it's very difficult to get out.
In the end, DeLeon says it'll be a legislative leadership decision whether his tobacco tax moves forward or not. That may well be the case for the oil and soda tax measures as well. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Last week, the federal receiver overseeing health care in California's prisons ordered the state to remove inmates at high risk of contracting valley fever from two Central Valley prisons. Yesterday, the State Department of Corrections replied to that directive. FM89's Rebecca Plevin reports as part of the Reporting on Health Collaborative's ongoing investigation into the disease.
In a motion filed in U.S. District Court yesterday, the state attorney general raised questions about the federal order to exclude inmates especially vulnerable to valley fever from two Central Valley prisons.
The receiver is calling for the transferring, and he described it last week as effective immediately, of over 3,000 inmates from those two prisons. That's a huge, complex undertaking. Could it happen? Of course it can happen, but it would take a long time to implement because it's very complicated.
Jeffrey Callison is a spokesman for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation.
And in its motion yesterday with the court, the state detailed just some of the many questions and issues that need to be resolved when you transfer even one inmate from one prison to another, let alone thousands in short order. So before the state could undertake that kind of complex procedure, there are other steps that need to be gone through first, both in court, both to fully vet the receiver's recommendations, and to let the process that's unfolding now with the CDC continue.
Callison says it's too quick to implement the receiver's recommendations for both logistical and public health reasons. He also says the issue is still making its way through the court system. A hearing on the matter is scheduled for June 17th. J. Clark Kelso is a federal receiver in charge of health care in California's prisons. Last Monday, he ordered that inmates who are at high risk of contracting valley fever and more likely to die from the disease should be expelled from Avenal State Prison in Kings County and Pleasant Valley State Prison in Fresno County. The goal of the policy is to reduce the risks of the disease to a, quote, reasonable level. The order, filed with the court on May 1st, pertains to African Americans and Filipinos. According to the document, black inmates had a 90% higher risk of the disease leaving the lungs and spreading to other parts of the body than white inmates. Blacks comprise about one-fourth of the population at Pleasant Valley and Avenal prisons. The directive also impacts inmates older than 55, pregnant inmates, and inmates with HIV or suppressed immune systems. The policy was updated last Wednesday to also include inmates with diabetes. With that addition, an estimated 50% of inmates at the two prisons will now be impacted by the order. Donald Spector is the executive director of the Prison Law Office in Berkeley. His organization brought the lawsuit that resulted in the prison's medical care system being put under receivership. In September, the office alerted the receiver to the fact that the state had been unsuccessful in reducing rates of valley fever since 2006. Spector says valley fever is another health issue that the state hasn't responded to appropriately.
Unfortunately, they have not treated it like it's a public health emergency. They've treated it just as business as usual. This kind of injury or death had happened in the free world, those institutions would have been closed long ago.
Kelso agrees. The receiver's May 1st court filing says the state did undertake some efforts to reduce dust at the institutions. But it alleges the state has moved slowly to develop a plan for responding to the ongoing threat of valley fever at the prisons. As part of the directive, the receiver has also instructed the prison system to request the help of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health to study valley fever at the two prisons. Spector says this data could help determine the next steps.
We're interested to hear those results. They will tell us whether there are any ways that the risk can be mitigated. And if not, then closing the prisons might be the only alternative.
Jason Feldman is a Venice-based lawyer who helped a former Taft Correctional Institution inmate earn a settlement from the U.S. government after the inmate acquired valley fever in the federal prison. Feldman says the healthcare directive is a step in the right direction.
You know, short of closing these prisons, this is a step in the right direction, but it is not a complete solution by any means. We'd like to see this even go further. I mean, this focuses on the two prisons that have the largest problem in Pleasant Valley and Avenal, but there are several other prisons and institutions that are in the San Joaquin Valley that could use a directive like this or similar to this.
Health experts say that both Pleasant Valley and Avenal State Prisons are located in areas where prisoners are exposed to the airborne fungus that causes valley fever. In 2005, the valley fever rate at Pleasant Valley was 600 times the rate of Fresno County. Experts say there are several reasons inmates experience high rates of valley fever. Many come from outside the region, so they have never been exposed to the fungus that causes the disease. They spend lots of time outdoors in the dusty prison yard, where they could inhale the spores. And many inmates already have weakened immune systems due to diseases like AIDS or hepatitis. With Valley Public Radio and the Reporting on Health Collaborative, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
This is Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
What happens when society fails to care about people? And why do our priorities as individuals differ so much from our actions as businesses and lawmakers? In this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business law professor Ida Jones says that uncontrolled greed and a civilized society are incompatible.
What does a civilized society look like? Isn't it one where individuals and corporations take responsibility for their own actions, good and bad? Isn't it one where government representatives, our representatives, look at the big picture when passing laws? Isn't it one where greed, profit at all costs, has a lower priority than fostering individual health, welfare, and happiness? Throughout the past year, I've talked about a number of issues involving uncontrolled greed and society as a whole. I've recommended that companies tie CEO pay to performance, not just to what other executives are paid, and to close the pay gap between workers and their bosses. I've called for tax code changes so that when businesses are convicted of crimes, they can't write off the penalties. I've recommended that government strengthen regulations on the finance industry to prevent future taxpayer bailouts, continue to recover funds from the mortgage companies who helped cause the crisis, and continue aggressive prosecution of those who violated the law. These examples all involve the impact of uncontrolled greed on the economy and, more importantly, on citizens and taxpayers. But the examples are also symptoms of a deeper problem, society's failure to care about people. Now, this lack of care is not found at an individual level. There are many examples of people helping people. A most recent example is the people who banded together to raise money to help the boat owner in whose boat the Boston Marathon bomber hid. As you may recall, the boat was riddled with bullets during law enforcement's successful effort to capture the bomber. Numerous people, strangers to the boat owner, raised money for him to get a new boat. And people's aid to each other is heartwarming during disasters. For example, the public's generosity after the recent fire and explosion at the Texas fertilizer plant, and the outpouring of donations after Hurricane Sandy. It's not the failure of individuals that's the problem. Instead, it's society's failure to care for and about others that's the problem. It's reflected in lawmakers' actions that permit greedy corporations to avoid accountability and to avoid responsibility. It's reflected in business policies that reward CEOs with exponentially higher pay, even when they run their companies into financial ruin. It's reflected in business policies that ignore employees' need for a livable wage, something more than minimum wage, and employees' need for affordable health care. What does a civilized society look like? Isn't it where everyone takes responsibility for their actions? Isn't it where government passes laws that protect society's long-term interests? Isn't it where greed, or profit at all costs, has a lower priority than fostering individual health, welfare, and happiness? I hope so. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Joe Moore. California's highest court has come down on the side of cities and counties in the fight over the location or even the existence of medical marijuana dispensaries. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento.
The California Supreme Court has ruled cities and counties have the right under law to regulate the location of dispensaries within their borders. The ruling stems from a case involving Riverside. A local dispensary was told it was violating city zoning laws and had to shut down. The dispensary then challenged the city in court. The League of California Cities backed Riverside in the case. Executive Director Chris McKenzie says this is an issue of local control.
Cities can decide whether they want none, whether they want a few, or they want many. We are concerned if cities can't decide that.
The court found state laws allowing access to medical marijuana don't guarantee that access will be convenient. The ruling was disappointing to Don Duncan, the California director of Americans for Safe Access, but he tried to stay positive.
I think the silver lining from the Supreme Court decision is that they do refer to dispensaries as legal businesses, which I hope will be reassuring to people, and they also call on the state legislature to do something about this issue, so that's a big step forward.
There are two bills pending in the legislature that Duncan says would provide additional regulation and legitimacy to medical marijuana. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
For more state and local news headlines, visit our website online at kvpr.org. This is Valley Public Radio News.
Hi, Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, this weekend, the CSU Bakersfield Amphitheater will be filled with music lovers as the 27th annual Bakersfield Jazz Festival begins its run. This year's festival not only features some big names from around the globe, but also some of the best talent that the Valley has to offer. FM89's Joe Moore recently spoke with festival director Doug Davis.
Doug Davis, thanks for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Well, so glad to be with you, Joe.
Doug, the festival is always a really fun weekend for people, celebration of the musical talent the Valley has, and some big headliners as well. This is the 27th year that you've been doing this festival, and this year's event is another very special one with some really great talent over 2 days. Let's start out and talk about Friday evening that opens the festival, and you have some big names on Friday to start things out, including a great vibraphonist who's famous both in jazz and in soul and R&B circles, the great Roy Ayers.
Certainly. Roy Ayers is one of those talents that has been on the scene for probably about 3 or 4 decades. He came to the fore in the 70s, and he had almost one or two recordings every year after that. And then in more recent times, he is connected up with some of the more contemporary young artists like Tupac and Ice Cube, and they pretty much think of him as the godfather of neo-soul. He promises to light things up on Friday night. And we have Billy Vera, and he's coming with a big band. And this singer has made his name because he wrote the theme music for Family Ties somewhere in the 1980s. But he also had a live show that featured horns, and he's now bringing 16 horns with him. So it should be pretty extraordinary on Friday night.
And then you also have some local talent on Friday night as well, a great local bassist.
Yes, Robin Bramlett is bringing her band, and she's just recorded another CD. And with her will be another Bakersfield icon of really the groove jazz, and that's Darren Goldston. And Robin Bramlett is sure to lay down the grooves on Friday night.
What's it like for Bakersfield artists to be able to perform on this type of a stage and share the stage in their hometown with some internationally famous artists and really showcase the quality of the musicians we have here in the Valley? I've always said the musicians here in Central California are as good as they are anywhere, and it has to be great for them to appear on the same stage as some of these great artists in front of a great audience as well.
It's certainly a highlight for any of the players. And, of course, if you have this opportunity to be on the same bill as some of these headliners, for many it's a once-in-a-lifetime moment. And almost all the artists have done something very special if they're local artists. They come out with a new CD, and I always feature original compositions by the local musicians. I know this year as well, on Saturday, we have the return of one of our former students who went on to get his doctorate at the University of Oregon and is now teaching in the Seattle area, and who's been featured at Spoleto festivals and is quite a composer. And he's coming back with all new music that he's written and bringing down a Seattle-based quartet, and that's Rob Hutchinson. So for him, you know, to come back 20 years later to his home stomping ground and be able to showcase his talent as a player, but also his compositional talent, I'm sure, you know, is a wonderful highlight in his career.
And for our listeners who don't know, for many years, Doug Davis, who joins us now on Valley Public Radio, has run the jazz program at CSU Bakersfield and has turned out so many great musicians. Many of them, as he mentioned, will be on the stage at the CSU Bakersfield Amphitheater for the Bakersfield Jazz Festival, the 27th annual event taking place Friday and Saturday, May 10th and 11th. Saturday, you also have some other big headliners. Tell us about Clayton Cameron and the rest of the groups performing.
Clayton Cameron is a fantastic drummer, and I first encountered him when he was playing with Kenny Burrell in a local concert and then at the jazz festival at an earlier festival. And he came out with a recording dedicated to the legendary drummer Art Blakey, and he's put together a sextet with a three-horn front. It's going to feature some young talents, just like Art Blakey, and Clayton Cameron is following in those footsteps, bringing with him a couple of members from the Thelonious Monk Institute in Los Angeles. And actually, we have a returning piano player from Bakersfield who is only 14 years old, but has already been recognized in the Jazz Society and won an award from Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter as the best young jazz talent. And he's coming back as a sideman on piano as a 14-year-old. But in that same group is like the bass player Dark Oles, who is, you know, won awards as like the top European bass player. So it should be a fun mix of great talent from the old school, if you will, and young talent as joining them and learning from them, I'm sure.
And you also have a great mix of artists, some of whom are, as you said, more traditional, more old school, like Clayton Cameron, and also some more groove jazz or smooth jazz style artists, including this year's headliner, correct?
Right. Huge Groove, what a great name, is going to be the headliner on Saturday night. And before him, we do have a fireworks show. We started it for the 20th, and it's just kept going. Certainly, it's fun for the families that come out to the festival. And since everyone under 12 is free, so it makes it a little bit affordable to bring out the entire family. And but Huge Groove, you know, has had many number one Billboard chart hits. And I'm sure he'll have everyone up and dancing. And before him, we have the Bay Area top salsa band called Avance. And they have three singers and four horns. And that's sure is going to be quite an exciting end to the festival on Saturday night.
Doug, this event is, as you said, a great family event. It's fun. It has something for everyone. You don't really have to be necessarily a diehard jazz fan to have fun at this event, correct?
Oh, that's true. In fact, if I have one credo for pulling together the groups that play at the festival, it's to make sure that I have plenty of variety. And so you'll have contemporary jazz, both from the, you know, bebop tradition forward, but also the smooth jazz is represented, Latin jazz. I, of course, have a big band quite often as well. In terms of the music, there's something for everybody.
Looking back now that the festival is in its 27th year and it's been such a great success, I know it's a huge labor of love on the part of yourself and your wife and everyone else at the university who helps put this together. Did you ever imagine it growing to the level it has now and to continue for nearly three decades now?
Well, its longevity is really a tribute to the jazz lovers in the community who come out and support it. And certainly I think we try to spread the good news to the young listeners who maybe haven't encountered that much jazz. And I know for our Cal State students, this is a great opportunity for them to have a wonderful outing and a great festive environment and get to hear some super music. And it's those jazz lovers and the community support through the corporations in town that have kept the festival healthy and continuing.
Well, it certainly sounds like an exciting lineup this year and something for everybody. Doug Davis joins us on Valley Public Radio today. Doug, if someone is listening out there and is interested in attending the festival, maybe wants to get tickets, what can they do? What should they do?
Well, they can check out our website at bakersfieldjazz.com. Also, tickets are available through valleytix.com, and they could call 661-322-5200 to get tickets. I encourage everyone to come on out and enjoy themselves. It's going to be a wonderful 2 days.
We've been talking with Doug Davis, the director of the Bakersfield Jazz Festival, celebrating its 27th year this weekend, Friday and Saturday at the CSU Bakersfield Amphitheater. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Joe, for that interview. I don't know about you all out there, but the Bakersfield Jazz Festival sounds like the place to be this weekend. Some great entertainment. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can also email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weber, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.